very first episode of Critical Analysis, a podcast focusing on unusual but important ways and factors of analyzing literature and its deeper components, meanings, ideals, symbols, and values. For the kickoff episode, I've decided to dive into a book often called the greatest American novel, The Great Gatsby. Heads up, spoiler alert. Okay. Everybody has heard about The Great Gatsby at some point in their schooling, likely read it too, and it can start to seem a bit, well, old at times. As a book often criticized as being purely representative of upper-class white problems and completely unrepresentative of the general population of America, many individuals turn away at the first mention of a deeper dive into the novel and dispute its portrayal as describing a truly American experience. And these are certainly valid criticisms. I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald, the book's author, seemed to be the definition of upper-middle-class white society. Fitzgerald was born into an upper-middle-class family in Minnesota in 1896, went to Princeton University after attending two private college preparatory schools, flunked out of the university only to return, joined the army in 1917, where he fell in love with Zelda Sayre, his future wife and the daughter of an Alabama Supreme Court judge, and went on to become a successful novelist. So, a pretty cut-and-dry example of a privileged upper-class white man in the early 1900s. Or that is how his life is often portrayed. Like with many of the characters in The Great Gatsby, Fitzgerald's wondrous life was, in part, skewed by time and personal narratives. His life was not all golden, in fact, far from it. While he did return after flunking out of Princeton, his social status and lover were gone. This was part of the reason he joined the army. As a man of low status, he likely saw little choice in the matter. He became engaged to Zelda Sayre, only for her to break off the marriage because of his lack of money, leading him to become dependent on alcohol to solve his problems. Even after returning to writing and gaining Zelda back with his newfound wealth, his alcoholism continued. Fitzgerald became terrified of losing his wealth and money, as portrayed through themes present in many of his novels, and after moving to France with his wife, he fell back into a deep alcoholism. Zelda eventually suffered a mental break that she never fully recovered from, and Fitzgerald was so distressed by this that he strayed away from her and their child, living with another woman until he died of a heart attack at the age of 44, leaving one of his novels in progress half finished. So, not exactly the beautiful life that so many associate with Fitzgerald. Obviously, Fitzgerald's life was full of ups and downs. But which was the greatest, the defining characteristic of his life? Was his privilege and upbringing in life enough to isolate him, and thus the themes of his novels, from the experience of at least a good group of Americans? Or did his flaws and unfortunate happenings lead to his novels having a certain universal flavor to them, themes that practically every individual can connect to? The thing is, we really can't say. Well, at least not collectively. As I first learned about Fitzgerald, he was presented as a rich white man who wrote books about rich white men for other rich white men. The Great Gatsby had, previously in my life, been framed as just that, a novel of privilege that was unrelatable, out of touch, the epitome of the wealthy white life. And so as I started into the novel, I came in with that mindset. A mindset which emphasized the disillusionment that so many readers feel today, and the idea of the book as a representation of privilege. But what if that hadn't been the case? What if I had, say, heard all of the hardships of Fitzgerald's life, his fall from glory per se, like in the second description of his life I gave earlier? Would I have believed that the book was more relatable, more down to earth? Further, what if two individuals from similar backgrounds listened to the two different descriptions of Fitzgerald's life that I have given? Would they then have a different opinion about The Great Gatsby? Most likely, yes. But why is that? I mean, the text of the book is the same, and the individuals in this hypothetical were chosen because of their shared backgrounds and life experiences. The key here is emphasis. What was emphasized in the reader's mind when they read the book? Emphasis. That is the true focus of this episode. Emphasis in relation to The Great Gatsby for both the book and movie. I'll be discussing emphasis in two different contexts throughout this episode, so I'll mention them here. The first is the emphasis which the audience puts on the story, how they see it, like with the hypothetical we just discussed. The second is the similarities and differences between the book and movie. Both of these ideas are interconnected, and both share this classic novel in many different lights. How would readers from different backgrounds who put emphasis on different aspects of the novel interpret the book differently? How did Baz Luhrmann use emphasis in the movie versus Fitzgerald in the novel? Let's find out. All right, this is a transition over to part two, reader emphasis. When I was first introduced to The Great Gatsby, I told myself that I would hate it, that I should hate it. I had just finished reading Sula by Toni Morrison in my English class, a wonderfully tragic, purposefully sexual, and incredibly intriguing novel, and I absolutely loved it. Morrison had been willing to discuss some of the most beautiful and most disgusting parts of society, and delved into those important topics usually avoided by authors for the sake of creating a safe, non-offensive novel. I had never been introduced to an author like Toni Morrison at any point previously in my educational career, and Sula changed my view on what schools should be putting focus on, you could even say emphasis on. It made me see the great value of books focusing on groups that aren't. When I was first introduced to The Great Gatsby, I told myself that I would hate it, that I should hate it. I had just finished reading Sula by Toni Morrison in my English class, a wonderfully tragic, purposefully sexual, and incredibly intriguing novel, and I absolutely loved it. Morrison had been willing to discuss some of the most beautiful and most disgusting parts of society, and delved into those important topics usually avoided by authors for the sake of creating a safe, non-offensive novel. I had never been introduced to an author like Toni Morrison at any point previously in my educational career, and Sula changed my view on what schools should be putting focus, you could even say emphasis, on. It made me see the great value of books focusing on groups that aren't the majority, and yet have themes that encapsulate problems and ideas that bring humanity together. So it is no surprise to me that when the next novel we would be discussing was announced as The Great Gatsby, there was an audible groan in the class. A book so often thought of as the pinnacle of white, upper-class American classics. I believe it was because of this, because of the almost cliché nature of the novel, along with the expectations that had been set by Morrison's work, that I was determined to hate The Great Gatsby. And as I read the first chapter of the novel, one that I will admit even now came on a bit slow, I subconsciously looked for things to hate. Every time something came along that showed elements my brain considered the out-of-touch nature of privileged men, I would shun it, emphasize that negative idea in my mind, with no mind to that element's importance to the greater storyline. And so I had settled with myself on the conclusion that this truly was a dull, unrelatable book that I was doomed to read to please the common core, and as such read with intense and purposeful displeasure. That is, until I had an interesting discussion with our student teacher. One day, in the middle of having a large group discussion about the novel's second chapter, our student teacher, let's call her Miss S., asked the class about the significance of the character of Mr. McKee. For all of you out there who have forgotten him, and believe me when I say I don't blame you, let me give you a bit of a refresher. The second half of Chapter 2 of The Great Gatsby focuses on a rather upsetting party thrown by Tom Buchanan, Nick's friend from college, and Tom's mistress, Myrtle Wilson. In attendance were Myrtle's sister, Catherine, and Mr. and Mrs. McKee, who lived in this flat below Myrtle's in New York. Miss McKee is described as a woman who was, quote, shrill, languid, handsome, and horrible, as stated on page 30. And we don't really learn much more about her, which is fine. The more important of the two, story-wise anyway, was Mr. McKee, a photography-obsessed, quote, pale, feminine man, also noted on page 30, who appears only in the second chapter. His main interactions consist of discussing photography with a wild passion and sleeping drunk in Myrtle's flat. So, a pretty standard, bland side character. Mr. McKee only really starts to become interesting after the abusive Tom breaks open Myrtle's nose for mentioning Daisy, his wife and Nick's cousin. In the chaos which follows, Mr. McKee and Nick leave and head down to the McKees' flat. We then go on to read about Nick's following interactions with Mr. McKee on pages 37 and 38, which goes as follows. Then Mr. McKee turned and continued on out the door. Taking my hat from the chandelier, I followed. Come to lunch someday, he suggested, as we groaned down the elevator. Where? Anywhere. Keep your hands off the lever, snapped the elevator boy. I beg your pardon, said Mr. McKee with dignity. I didn't know I was touching it. All right, I agreed. I'll be glad to. I was standing beside his bed, and he was sitting up between the sheets, clad in his underwear, with a great portfolio in his hands. Beauty and the Beast, Loneliness, Old Grocery Horse, Brooklyn Bridge. Then I was lying half asleep in the cold lower level of the Pennsylvania station, staring at the Morning Tribune, and waiting for the 4 o'clock train. Okay, back to the class discussion. What was the importance of Mr. McKee? At this point, I still had an intense focus on all things negative about this novel in my subconscious's never-ceasing quest to hate this book. So I figured it was some bland form of symbolism I hadn't picked up on. Maybe his photography represents an obsession with reflecting on life. I didn't know, and seemingly neither did my classmates, because it took Miss S. rereading, with an exaggerated tone of voice, the last half of Nick and Mr. McKee's interactions before someone finally got it. Wait, hang on, a voice from the back of the classroom, as Miss S. looked us up and down and stated something along the lines of, doesn't that sound like they had sex? The class went quiet. Not because the topic of sex came up. After all, we had just finished reading Sula, so sexual topics were no stranger in our class. No, the silence was because, despite every one of us in that class reading the same book and coming from multiple different walks of life, not one of us had come to that conclusion. I mean, I'm sure some of us had an idea of it. It did come as a fleeting thought in my mind while reading the first time over, but I pushed it away in my attempt to hate the idea of an unwavering theme of privilege in the book. We all had. And, I mean, it made sense. That they had sex, that is. As Miss S. pointed out, Mr. McKee is framed in the novel as almost overly feminine, one of Fitzgerald's many purposeful descriptions of character. And as the novel was originally published in 1925, the use of this somewhat stereotypical definition of a gay man would not be uncommon. Mr. McKee also invites Nick over to lunch, despite just meeting him. Not necessarily a sign of anything other than a platonic relationship, but it does certainly seem more powerful when read in context. And the final piece of the puzzle was the bit about Mr. McKee showing Nick his portfolio, on his bed and only in his underwear. That certainly could be interpreted as an intentional nod to sexual relations between the two. And here it was that the emphasis I put on this book, and especially on the character of Nick, suddenly changed. I started to feel more related to Nick. He seemed more human, less out of reach. Did Nick actually have a sexual relationship with Mr. McKee? Not necessarily. But the thing here is, it didn't really matter. Because now, my interpretation of the character had changed, and my mindset along with it. And my stubborn brain now saw what I interpreted as indisputable evidence of a break in the chain of privileged themes, a minority character, and one that I could relate to at that. So now my idea of The Great Gatsby as a purely majority-pandering book had faltered, and I started to see changes in how I saw the novel. I saw stark differences in what I took down in my notes, what I emphasized most when reading deeper and analyzing the text. Not only my notes changed, but my actual experience reading the book too. I started seeing more positive aspects of Fitzgerald's writings, ones which connected these characters to humanity, as my brain actively wanted to see the book in a positive light. My emphasis had completely changed, and with it the story, at least in my eyes. This, the changing of emphasis on a book, because my interpretation of the characters' backgrounds evolved in my mind to align better with my own personal values and biases, is a wonderful example of how the backgrounds and biases of readers can impact what they emphasize in a work, what points, interactions, and characters they deem important. This is the reader's emphasis. To expand on this idea of emphasis as a tool and experience specific to each individual reader, I sat down for a phone interview with Tate DeCaro. Ms. DeCaro is a graduate of Bard College with a degree in psychology who worked in the field of literature for over 5 years. She is also one of the most avid and passionate readers I know and, coincidentally, my aunt. So, hi! Thank you for coming on and joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's awesome to have you and, you know, talk to you. So, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions related to The Great Gatsby, and then also related to emphasis in literature in general, because I know you are really into literature, and you're one of the best, you're one of the most well-read people I know, so couldn't think of anybody better. So, first off, I know that you've read The Great Gatsby 2 times. How did you start to do that?
Well, I read it in high school at some point for school. And then, I don't remember what year it was, but a couple years ago, whatever year it was that the movie came out, the Baz Luhrmann movie.
I think that was 2013.
13, okay. My book club, we choose our books for the whole year in one sitting, and we always choose one what we call classic. So usually it's something that you might have read in high school, but, you know, some people didn't, or some people did, but it was a long time ago. And that year we chose The Great Gatsby, in part because we knew the movie was coming, so we could read the book and talk about it and then all go together to see the movie. So that's what we did.
That's cool. And what did you think of the book?
What I think of the book?
Yeah.
I did not love the book. The first or the second time.
Did it get any better for you when you read it, like, the second time?
You know, I don't really remember. I mean, I remember that I read it in high school, and I remember that it wasn't my favorite, although I can think of other books that I disliked more. So it was just sort of like I read that book, mm-hmm. you know, in high school. And so I don't really remember whether or not it got better. I know that obviously my reading tastes and my understanding of literature has changed a lot since high school. So I think I read it with that in mind and sort of knowing some of the background of what F. Scott Fitzgerald was trying to do. And I know we're going to talk about emphasis.
Yeah. You
know, obviously, that's part of it. You know, what his intention was as opposed to what the way it's often read.
That's really great, and I'm glad that you brought up emphasis, because, like you said, that is what we're talking about. And so I'm going to be talking about, and I think I've already introduced this earlier in the podcast for all the listeners, but I have chosen to look at 2 different types of emphasis today, the first being the emphasis that the reader puts on the novel, and the second type being the differences in emphasis between the book and movie, or just any two, like, adaptations. Mm-hmm. For discussing the emphasis that the reader puts on the book, I gave the example of my emphasis on the book changing once I started to believe that there was a main character that was also a minority character, and how that kind of changed my outlook on the book, and how instead of looking for negative aspects, I started looking for positive aspects, and this was all subconsciously, but I can notice it in my notes that I was writing and that sort of thing. So I was wondering, what particular things stood out to you that made you not like the book or not think it was super great?
Yeah. I think part of it for me, and, you know, like I was talking about Fitzgerald's intention with the book as opposed to how a lot of people read it, I think both times I read it as sort of a celebration of excesses. You know, the Gatsby and all these other people are just partying all the time. They have fancy cars and all this stuff. And for me, it was just, I was just sort of reading it like, I just don't care. I don't care about these people's lives. You know, I don't care how much money they have and how much money they spend and that kind of thing. I think it wasn't until after I read it the second time that I, when we were talking about it as a book club, that I sort of realized that Fitzgerald's intention with it, and, you know, I guess what we could say is sort of like what he intended to emphasize was more that it was a critique of those excesses and a sort of critique of the American dream. So I find that interesting, you know, even though I didn't really enjoy reading the book, I do think it has some value in it, and I do think that that is interesting, what he was trying to do, and, you know, what people often end up taking from it that's different from what he was trying to do.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Actually, one that I, when I was doing the rest of this podcast, I don't think I brought that up in such specific detail. So that's a really, really good point to make. One other question about just like the sort of what I gave it the nickname of the reader's emphasis, you know, the emphasis the reader puts on the book. I gave a hypothetical at the beginning of this podcast that was, I gave two different descriptions of Fitzgerald's life. One of those descriptions was talking about everything that sort of put him in this classification of typical, even stereotypical, rich, white, privileged man in the early 1900s, right?
Yeah.
And then a second one that was talking about all of the hardships of his life. So his problems struggling with alcoholism, his wife trying to sort of leech off of his wealth in a sense, just all of the big hardships that he went through with dealing with his wife, going through mental breaks, dropping out of his university, and sort of never getting back to the social status that he was, all that, you know, sort of stuff that I said, it kind of makes him feel more human and not as out of reach as he might seem at first. And the hypothetical that I posed there was, if two individuals from very similar backgrounds who had never heard of or read The Great Gatsby before or anything else by Fitzgerald, and they were each given those two different descriptions, or one of each was given one of those descriptions, would coming from a different background on the author change how they experienced the book, they have a different opinion about, say, the privileges shown in the book and Fitzgerald's opinion on those privileges. Yeah. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
I think that's absolutely true, you know. I think it's interesting to think about, you know, either these two sides of it, you know, thinking too about having like a third reader that you don't tell anything to. Mm-hmm. They don't even know the author's name or gender or race or anything. I think that would be three very different looks at that book. And I think if I had been told more, you know, if I had done more research or whatever about his life and known more of that kind of struggles that he went through, I probably would have liked the book a little bit more than looking at it from, you know, this guy's from an upper middle class white family, you know, he's in this, you know, I mean, he lived on Long Island and partied, and, you know, I mean, he based some of that on his own experiences, went to a prep school, I think, and all this stuff, and, mm-hmm. you know, so knowing that, then you look at the book and say, like, oh, well, he's just talking about how great that life was. So I definitely think it would make a difference.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for your input on that as well. So before I let you go, I wanted to ask you one last thing about the second type of emphasis that I am going to be discussing in the podcast, and that is the differences in emphasis between the book and the movie. And one question I had for you, and this is just a more general literature question, especially since I know that you are so involved with literature, is how do you think emphasis in books and specifically their movie adaptations is different? Like what different things? So sort of like example, one of the things that I am going to be talking about later on the podcast for all of the listeners out there is the difference in the book emphasizing descriptions of weather more, whereas the movie emphasizes music more, and both of those have sort of the same purpose to relay the emotions of the characters, but they're emphasized differently. So, do you think there's some sorts of things like that that are common or almost universal amongst books and their movie adaptations, like specific things that are emphasized more often in movies versus books?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really good insight as far as, you know, a book has to be much more descriptive, obviously, through words and talk about, like you said, the weather or, you know, what things look like, where a movie doesn't have to work as hard at that because they can just show it to you. So then there can be a, you know, focus on other things. I think another one that I notice a lot is in a movie, dialogue is key, mm-hmm. because you can't know someone's thoughts in a movie the mm-hmm. way that you know someone's thoughts in a book.
Yeah.
You know, so there's some books that it would be very difficult to adapt to a movie because the book is like all internal dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very difficult. I mean, you basically have to change the entire focus or emphasis of mm-hmm. the story in order to adapt that to a movie, because you can't just have a movie where people are walking around thinking all the time.
Yeah.
That's not very interesting to look at.
Yeah. And that's actually a really good point that you brought up, specifically because it relates back to something that I noticed about the movie that I didn't actually mention anywhere else in the podcast. So this is a really great place to bring it up. That in the movie, and I know that you watched the movie Once Upon a Time when it came out with your book club. So I'm not sure if you remember this part of it or not, but in the book, Nick is, in both the book and the movie, Nick is the narrator. He is writing this story, relaying his past experiences.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, he doesn't have to describe why he's doing that. There don't have to be any external factors because, like you said, if it's all just his personal thoughts that he wanted to put on a piece of paper and send out to the world, then that works fine in a book. But obviously that can't happen in a movie. And so in the movie, there's actually a starting scene of him talking to a therapist about him being chronic alcoholic, and his therapist suggests that he write down this story about Gatsby because he mentions that Gatsby was like the one person who was who he didn't scorn from that time.
Interesting. I didn't remember that about the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, with something like that, sometimes the movie has to create some way of explaining why, you know, you might hear Nick's voice and, you know, as a mm-hmm. as the narrator when things are happening, because in the, like you say, in the book, that doesn't need an explanation, but in a movie it does.
Yeah. That's super awesome. Well, I think that I'm gonna cut this interview right here because we've hit about 15 minutes, and I think that's a pretty good time for an interview. But I wanted to say thank you so, so much for joining us. And did you have anything else you wanted to say before we end the interview?
I don't think so. This has been fun, though.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
All right. Awesome.
After finishing up the book, our class shifted focus. Instead of discussing topics purely within the realm of the novel itself, we started to discuss the themes of the book and their changes in adaptations. Specifically, we watched and focused our comparisons on the 2013 movie The Great Gatsby, directed by Baz Luhrmann and starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby and Tobey Maguire as Nick. As we watched the movie, several things jumped out at me as odd, and I originally couldn't quite put my finger on it. I was sure that a great part of it was the absolutely unique style of directing and pacing which Baz Luhrmann brought to the film, with a tendency to push what I thought were relatively important scenes very quickly, such as the party at Myrtle's flat, while putting more runtime into aspects that seemed relatively unimportant, like the specifics of Gatsby's illegal business pursuits. But I knew that couldn't possibly explain the entirety of the odd feeling that I got for the movie, and so that became my focus while evaluating the film, trying desperately to figure out what made it seem so out of place in the Gatsby universe I had constructed in my mind. And then I figured it out. After watching the scene of Gatsby's dramatic house tour he presented for Daisy, I almost complained to myself about the emphasis that was being put on Klipspringer, a man who had been a minor and relatively forgettable character in the book. While in the novel, Klipspringer was mentioned as being a relatively good piano player, the movie chose to play up his musical talents, decorating him as a masterful but crazed musician and supposed descendant of Beethoven. Why, of all characters, make him important? He didn't even show up as a person of any importance at the end of the movie, with only a fleeting reference made to him at Gatsby's funeral, whereas in the novel, his betrayal of Gatsby and leeching off of his wealth is made very apparent. So why emphasis on him? And that's where it clicked. Emphasis. The oddness of the film had come not from pure pacing differences, nor had it come from inaccuracy to the source material. No, the weird feeling that I had experienced while watching the movie came from a difference in emphasis. Whereas the book had put very little emphasis on Klipspringer at the beginning and much more at its close, the movie had almost swapped this. And this was far from the only instance of a change in emphasis.
In fact, the entire movie seemed to run on the premise of a change in emphasis, certainly both a testament to Larman's style of directing, but also the differences in focus in varying forms of media and the resulting inevitable changes when creating an adaptation of any kind. One of the greatest uses of emphasis in the book is that put on weather. At the start of the novel, Fitzgerald takes care in describing the warm, changing environment that Nick encounters as he moves east, and uses this as a symbolic representation of the changes in Nick's life and his hope for his life's improvement. We can see this especially well on page 4. In this aspect, the weather is emphasized almost more so than the statements of Nick's actual specific emotions. And this makes sense, with the way that symbolism of emotions is embedded in and intertwined with weather patterns throughout the novel. Purely stating Nick's emotional state would be bland and repetitive in comparison. It is certainly a unique way to describe emotions, a take which looks at the human psyche in terms of pure symbolism, but in the context of the book, it kind of works. There are actually many more instances of weather being used to not only set the general tone, but to actually describe the character's emotions. One of the best examples of this is the enormous amount of focus and emphasis on heat, presented in chapters 7 and 8. The 7th and 8th chapters of The Great Gatsby are arguably the most tension and plot-filled of the book, where the stories of Gatsby and Tom's eventual fight over Daisy, Myrtle's gruesome death and its fallout, and Gatsby's murder are all played out in quick succession. At a glance, this may seem like way too much content to be crammed into a meager 2 chapters, which is what I originally thought when scanning for it in the book one night. It seems so likely to burn out the reader's sense of suspense by simply putting too much of it in front of them all at once. In other words, the amount of suspense and tension would seem unnatural, too unrealistic to be thought possible. But as I read those chapters, I found myself truly immersed in the story. Suspense was there all right, as was tension, but more subtly, brewing in the background. As if all of a sudden something in the world of the novel itself had changed to be more fitting for the events to come. As I read, I figured out that this was, in fact, the weather. Weather, always present in the book, had now become a tool for both building and keeping suspense and tension. As emotions started to grow more violent and tense in these chapters, the weather would become hotter, and more of the text focused on this heat. An example of this would be the characters' increasing comments on the heat as they head to the hotel room where the eventual great fight over Daisy breaks out. Even the breaking of Tom and Daisy's marriage is symbolized in mentions to weather, as stated on page 127. "Imagine marrying anybody in this heat," cried Jordan dismally. "Still, I was married in the middle of June," Daisy remembered. "Louisville in June. Somebody fainted. Who was it that fainted, Tom?" "Biloxi," he answered shortly. This particular quote uses descriptions of weather in the past to symbolize tensions and falling apart, seen in the Biloxi fainting, right after the current heat is mentioned, hinting at the falling apart and tension which is about to occur. In this way, the emphasis on weather becomes more intricate, meaningful, and an aspect of the book enhancing the experience in the background. I only notice this particular instance of a deeper emphasis and symbolism in connection to weather on a 3rd or 4th read-through of the second half of chapter 7. Obviously, this emphasis on weather in the novel was an incredibly important tool that Fitzgerald used when writing The Great Gatsby, and to me it worked brilliantly in making scenes which would otherwise seem rushed or unrealistic feel emotional and interesting, actually making the reader want to continue reading, as well as providing subtle but crucial details in the background of the book. So when we went into the film adaptation, I had expected a similar amount of emphasis on weather. It seemed like an unchangeable, defining characteristic of the story. But as I watched the beginning of the film, I quickly realized that I was wrong. This is not to say that the film did not incorporate weather at all. We still see Nick standing solemnly out in his yard as the rain pours down on him during Gatsby's initial meeting with Daisy, and the heat is mentioned by Tom and Daisy towards the end of the movie. However, the crucial difference here is that, just because the weather changes were present, they did not necessarily hold the same emphasis, and thus meaning, as in the book. Weather in the film was treated almost as a somewhat unwanted aspect, thrown in because without it, the movie would stray too far away from its source material. Weather is there all right, but it holds no particular importance other than to seemingly reference back to the novel. It lacks the emphasis it once held in the book. Admittedly, I was a bit disappointed in this lack of symbolic weather. It had become such an important and integral part of the story in my mind that I failed to see how you could have The Great Gatsby without it. Although this did somewhat dull my experience of the film, however, overall this lack of important weather did not seem to be so much a hole or weak spot. Rather, it seemed as if the film had changed what it emphasized, what aspects it found most important, not only in the world of books and novels, but also in that of filmmaking. Another aspect had replaced weather in this film, one that Lerman seemingly found to be more intriguing to those watching a movie, and thus critical for an adaptation across media. And what was this other aspect? Music. The music present in the film was one of the first things that I noticed while watching it, although it took a while for me to realize its relationship with weather in the book. Instead of songs that we would typically associate with the 1920s jazz age, the film instead featured contemporary artists such as Lana Del Rey, Fergie, will.i.am, Beyoncé, and Florence and the Machine, among others. This certainly seems like an odd choice at first. I mean, if one is trying to set the scene of a summer in the 1920s, why not put in music to match that scene? Hearing A Little Party Never Killed Nobody by Fergie, Q-Tip, and Goon Rock certainly has an effect of pulling one's mind out of the fantasy of being transported back in time, and provides an especially weird contrast to the men in full suits and women in flapper dresses and Hallmark 1920s bathing suits seen on screen. So why then, if contemporary music seemingly breaks the illusion of the film, make practically every song related to this genre? The key here, as it has been throughout the podcast, is emphasis. Lerman, in choosing these particular songs, knew that they would seem out of place and pull the audience's attention towards it. And this decision, in a way, actually ended up being a tool for better immersing audiences in the story overall, no matter how contradictory that may sound. The reason for this? The music in the film parallels weather in the novel. It works to set tone and show emotions, to describe the experiences and feelings of the characters without relying on the direct statement of these facts. This makes the experience more immersive, showing the audience the story rather than just relaying the facts. And as such, the film's emphasis on music builds tension and suspense, just as weather does in the novel. A great example of this is the specific use of music when showing the aftermath of Gatsby's party, which Daisy attended. In the novel, the settings of twilight and darkness act alongside subtle descriptions of cooler weather to suggest both the romantic and depressing undertones of the scene. Whereas in the film, brilliant, swelling music takes over this role, at times becoming almost louder than the voices of the characters themselves. This is an obvious use of emphasis, using music to convey the emotions, while characters themselves speak in an almost monotone voice, such as with the following clip, in which Gatsby and Nick discuss Gatsby's past, an obsession with loving Daisy.
If I could just get back to the star. If I could just get back to the star, I could find it again.
Some vision of himself that he had put into loving Daisy.
While the differences in emphasis in terms of weather and music are certainly some of the most obvious examples of the changes in emphasis across the two medias, there are many, many other smaller but still crucial instances of this occurring. These range from a greater emphasis on Gatsby's illegal pursuits in the film versus his act of hiding those pursuits in the book, to emphasizing the characteristics of Tom in the movie more so than Daisy in the film, in a way quite opposite from the novel, to a greater focus on the more sexual undertones in the film. Just like is the case with weather and music, all of these changes were purposeful, put in to serve some sort of cause and enhance the particular type of media in which they were being portrayed. While not all individuals may appreciate the differences in this film specifically, it is important to note that the changes in emphasis across any two medias is often a necessary tool to create an interesting and coherent adaptation, such as is the case with The Great Gatsby novel and movie, as an entire book with such great uses of emphasis simply couldn't be replicated in film as an exact copy. Artistic changes and liberties had to be taken and made. And Baz Luhrmann and the cast and crew of The Great Gatsby film took on this challenge to the best of their abilities. In the end, emphasis truly proves itself to be a tool for both storytelling and important change. By investigating both the emphasis an individual reader puts on a text, and the differences in which types of media prioritize and emphasize elements of a story, a better understanding of both the process of creation and the story itself can be achieved. And what better story to show this with than a story so ingrained in our minds and seemingly culture as The Great Gatsby? Thank you so much for tuning in for the very first episode of Critical Analysis. I hope that you have enjoyed it. If you have, please let me know. If you have any ideas, make sure to send those in. Thank you again, and see you next time.